Lars. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Appreciate it. So, science reporting in the age of sound bites. I realize that that sounds a little sound bitey itself, but we'll see. So, I'm basically going to talk about my background and how I became a science writer, because you might be just wondering, you know, how that happens to a person. and then also a little bit about how Quantum Magazine came to be and what it is for people who aren't familiar, just because I'm a big fan, so I like to proselytize a bit. And then also how a science article comes together. And I'm going to focus on the gravitational wave story that we did at the time of the discovery, just because I think it might be interesting for some of you to hear about what that was like from my perspective, you know, outside of the group or the collaboration, kind of trying to report the story and get a behind-the-scenes look before the announcement. It's pretty tricky. So, so my own story is that I decided to become a physicist when I read A Brief History of Time at age 13. I think it was the 10th anniversary edition of the book. It was in bookstores everywhere, so I picked it up, and I just completely fell in love with physics. I think it was just this idea of unification, of explaining disparate phenomena with fewer and fewer underlying principles. That struck me as the most important thing to do and to think about, and so from that point on, I just knew I wanted to be a physicist. But then, in terms of just, you know, outside pressures, my family is a very literary family. There's no scientists. We're all about books, reading and writing, talking about language. So my interest in science, which is predated specifically focus on physics, was really coming out of nowhere. I still don't really know why I'm so interested in it, based on my thinking about my roots. But I think that over time, you know, those two competing kind of interests converge in what I do now. So anyway, so I went to Tufts University for undergrad, majored in physics, did a lot of research during my undergrad career in nonlinear optics, especially supercontinuum generation, in case anybody knows what that is. So I was really heavily involved in research there. Like, I visited collaborators groups, gave talks at conferences, co-authored several papers, and I still was completely gung-ho about physics. So from there, I went to grad school at Berkeley, which is just where I'd always wanted to go. This was like my dream. And I really liked it there, but then something kind of remarkable happened that I don't really understand very well, which is that basically in the course of one sleepless night during my first year at Berkeley, I had a complete crisis and realized that I didn't want to be a physicist. I wanted to be a physics writer. and it's kind of hard for me to understand, you know, what happened, but I think I was, in being in grad school, I was realizing more and more what it would be like to be a physicist and how, you know, you do have to focus so much. And I was seeing that maybe in focusing so much, I would lose what I really liked about physics, which is the which is learning basically as much as possible about many different areas and the state of knowledge and how our different theories kind of fit together, and having that like broader view. And I realized that, you know, my love of reading and writing and language and putting kind of distilling concepts into clear language was being lost in my pursuit of physics. So I decided in the course of this night to try to become a physics writer, and I dropped out of Berkeley the very next day, which is like insane. So But I was just really confident that it would work out. So I started tutoring physics college students to earn money and just writing a blog and pitching articles and applying for internships. And eventually got an internship at Popular Science and a combined one with Science Illustrated, which I think doesn't exist anymore, but it was a partner magazine. So I moved to New York, worked at Popular Science. I think this was like my biggest article that I had done ever, and I just really slaved away at this article on my own time. And so I really tried really hard at this internship, and about when it was ending, one of the editors at Popular Science was leaving to go be in charge of a small science website. So he brought me along as the first staff writer. So that website was called Life's Little Mysteries. It's a part of a group of websites with Live Science and Space.com and some others. So it's part of this online ecosystem of like all these websites that you kind of don't know where they're making money and what they're doing. And it was after being there, I still don't really know that, and they don't really know either. It's just people are trying to make science journalism work. But I got to do a lot of cool stuff, like basically answering science questions that people have. For example, this one is, you know, do we all see the same colors? And actually doing a lot of reporting and, you know, just really speedily producing these articles, like two articles a day sometimes. So it was an environment that, you know, was really great for cutting your teeth, but I really wanted out. I wanted to be somewhere where I could really dive a little deeper, do more physics reporting. And so luckily for me, right when I was starting to look around for something else, the Simons Foundation was also kind of looking around, thinking about starting a science magazine. So this is the progression of Quanta. It started in 2012 as Simons Science News, just on a page on their website. Started as me plus the editor, Thomas Lin, and then a bunch of freelance writers. And so we had the articles here on this this random page, but then we also syndicated them to bigger publications like Wired, Scientific American. So they started getting out there, and we were kind of preparing to launch officially. So then in 2013 we launched Quanta, and then we just got a facelift this year. So what is Quanta? Our mission is to enhance public understanding of research developments in mathematics and the physical and life sciences. So basically, the goal is to cover areas of science that a lot of the other publications are kind of not doing justice to. So mathematics research, obviously, there's just not a lot of coverage of that. Physics, there's some coverage of, obviously, LIGO gets covered, but there's a lot of theoretical physics, new ideas, tricky to explain stuff like the amplitudohedron here that no one else is covering. The sort of mission that we set for ourselves, or our approach, is to cover like really truly cutting edge developments. So stuff that's actual news to scientists, not just something that gets handed to us in a press release that real scientists don't actually think is that important. So how we do that is really just on the ground reporting. Like I have a lot of sources that I'm in touch with a lot, who I can email and be like, hey, what's going on in your area, or if I catch wind of something on a blog or on archive, I'll just be like, do you think this is important? Is this worth us covering? So it's really trying to build up our network of sources in the community to where, over time, I think I'm getting a better and better sense of the lay of the land and you know, if something new happens, I have more of a context for it.
So do you look regularly at the archive? Is that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's tricky because then, because for me, I'm just looking at catchier headlines and, you know, trying to avoid the science in the age of sound bites type of approach. So that is hard. But sometimes I'll see a headline or maybe an author that I know is, you know, notable, and so then I'll follow up and see if it's really something worth covering. But often it's also blogs or maybe it got covered somewhere, but in a cursory way, and it's something that I'm like, oh, that's not really what the story is, and or there's a much bigger story here, so let me do a bit more digging. So we also try to illuminate the discovery process and, you know, help people understand how science works, not just what was found, because I think people don't necessarily care what was found without the story of, you know, how we got there and also why the scientists came to the conclusion that they did. That's a better way of presenting the information than just here's the new, you know, latest thing. And so, you know, related to that, it's engaging readers through storytelling is really the trick, because people learn and remember things if it's told as a story. And I think it takes time to learn what the story is behind some new development, and to figure out which elements you need to include to make the story work, and how to construct it, where you have like both the news being presented, but then how you wrap that back around into, okay, now we're going to go back to the beginning and tell you the story so that now you can understand like how we got here. So all of that is, you know, it's a craft and it takes a lot of time. Unfortunately, like at Quanta, we can take time to do that. And I think in the end, the articles are more impactful because it's told in that way. So then another goal is obviously to reach as many people as possible. And over time, we've really, you know, seen our traffic grow a lot. It's going in the right direction. And then we also have maybe a few million more page views each year through syndication. So Wired, now it's The Atlantic is a big one, some others. So how
many writers?
So we have two staff writers only, but then a large stable of freelancers who will either pitch stuff to us, or if one of us doesn't have time to do it, we'll ask someone else to cover something. And then we have two editors, an art director, and a news assistant, and that's the team. So it's a small team, but with a lot of help from freelancers, and you know, we hire photographers and use freelance copy editors and fact checkers. So speaking of that, another of our big missions is accuracy, because that's how we build up trust among scientists, is just accurately reporting their findings so that they'll talk to us again. And so this is a document, you can't see it, but you get the picture, after it's come back from the fact checker. So this I think the pink ones are maybe my comments to the fact checker, but basically this was sent to them as, okay, we've finished the story, here it is, and then this is them sending the notes back with highlighting errors or places where they say, maybe it's not an error, but it's, well, this person said about this, that blah, 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 blah. You know, sometimes the reaction is, well, of course that person said that, but it wasn't either weird. You know, but then sometimes you have to make changes.
Sometimes some of us may get a call from a fact checker, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So after we've
heard, you want us to answer the call, yeah?
Definitely. Yeah. So usually they'll use the same sources that we used for the reporting the story. Sometimes there's a few extras if there's just people who are really knowledgeable in that field. So usually it's, you know, not a completely out of the blue surprise to get a call because you've already talked to the reporter. But yeah. So that's just a really important part of the process. The fact checker has saved me a lot of times. Okay, so I also just wanted to briefly talk about like the different types of content that we have now. So we have, our regular, our bread and butter is just the Quanta feature story, like 1,500 to 4,000 words, in-depth story. It might have, you know, art commission to go along with it, graphics to help explain concepts, photos, we'll hire photographers. But yeah, so that's a story. We also have a video series with David Kaplan. So short videos about interesting ideas. And then Abstractions, the blog, it's very new. We just launched it. And that's basically, if we think something's cool, but we're not going to invest the time for an entire story on it, or it's maybe a follow-up on the story we've already done, we'll do a blog post. And then we also have a puzzle column. We have columns by scientists, which doesn't have a logo. And then, this is a really cool feature that we have that we created. Is it going to come up? I don't know how to make it come up there. Do we have anyone who knows that? But anyway, this is a physics map, theories of everything mapped. It's basically an interactive graphic where you can explore some of the biggest questions in fundamental physics. And then also these little dots are like different theories that try to address that that question. And then you can see how the dots are connected. And you can also vote on the theories you like the best. So that's been, I think it's like our most popular content. And that was like a huge project that I did last year with an interactive developer. So people who like physics should.
How do you prioritize these stories? I mean, you want to go for the very latest, or maybe something that was already covered somewhere else, but now you leave it there?
Yeah, it's kind of either of those. Like we'd love to break a story because, you know, if something's already been covered, but then you just cover it doing a better job, people think they've already heard about it, so they don't necessarily read the more in-depth piece. But we really want to break news. But if something really does need to be covered more in-depth, we also, I mean, we're not chasing traffic all the time, so we would cover something really important later if we needed to. It's kind of, story selection is really tricky. It's probably, you know, that's the hardest part of this, is figuring out, like, what's worth covering, because we don't want to, because that's also important for maintaining, like, the trust of our readers, that if we're covering it, then it is important.
Is there any tendency to cover a Simons Foundation sponsored?
No, so we're editorially independent, and it's been, you know, at times it's been tricky to maintain that separation, but it's really important to us because we're not beholden to anyone. Sometimes we do cover research that they've funded just because they choose great people to fund. But we'll say something at the bottom of the story, like this is such and so is funded by the Simons Foundation, so people know. So it's all transparent.
Are you worried about a U.S. bias because your network is here?
Oh, yeah, I think so. Yeah, I'm worried about that. Yeah. and then another worry is that I think it's like 15% of our readers are women. It's very bad. And we're not really sure why, and it's something that we really are actively trying to address through just... Sorry?
How do you know that?
We've done some reader surveys and things like that. So, yeah. Any other questions? All right, so I wanted to talk about how a science article gets. So the gravitational wave discovery was really exciting. The rumors were starting to circulate pretty soon after the big event came in, September 14th of last year. So science reporters were kind of starting to feel nervous, like, oh, we should really be, you know, we need to be figuring out what's going on behind the scenes, but LIGO is very secretive, so so that was tricky. So I think I really started looking into it. I think it was maybe early January, because there were rumors that the presentation would be sometime in February of the results. And even then, you know, it wasn't clear if it would just be a presentation of their results so far and no detection, or, you know, it wasn't guaranteed that there would be a signal to report, but of course there were these rumors. So for me, you know, initially I just contacted the spokespeople and was kind of like, oh, you know, I'd like to talk about just how the experiment works, and, you know, obviously we would respect any embargo, so if you'd like to tell us what you guys are doing. And they were not having any of that. So that was sort of a dead end with the official LIGO leadership. And by the way, hasn't always been this way, but I think certain things like BICEP 2 fiasco, it's become a little harder to, I think, for journalists to get an in with these kinds of big announcements. I don't know. I see a sort of relationship there. But anyway, so that was a no-go with the leaders. So in my onerous reporting of trying to understand the, you know, how the experiment worked and how it came together, going back to wanting to tell this as a story, I read a book called Traveling at the Speed of Thought by Daniel Kenefick about the history of gravitational wave theory and experiment. And so I learned, you know, who the key characters were, like Ray Weiss and Kit Thorne and Ron Drever. And, you know, it was kind of hard, it was kind of tricky to figure out what the story was before it became such a famous story. You know, those three guys, their names were on the Wikipedia page, but it was unclear, like, were they, you know, but I don't know. It wasn't all just laid out, like, how you would tell this. But anyway, so by reading this book, Traveling at the Speed of Thought, I figured out that they were really the people to talk to about, like, the ancient history. And so I sent Ray Weiss an email. And it was a little bit, it was sly, I guess. I sent him, you know, I said I wanted to talk to him about just the background so that in preparation for the announcement, I would have, like, you know, information that then I could just slap the news on top of and, you know, flesh out my story that way. So I said, I'm just trying to report on background, like, about the history of the experiment. But I included some questions, like, you know, so how did you think up this idea? When did you think up the idea? Who, you know, weren't there other people at the same time kind of also thinking about things? And also, like, I don't quite understand you and Ron Drever's relationship or the roles that you both played. So for people who don't know this, these are things that, you know, their relationship is fraught, I would say. So this really caught his attention, and he wrote back, yes, I'll talk to you. So so I had this great phone call with him where he kind of took me through the entire history of it. And then about an hour and a half in, he was so excited that he couldn't help it. He told me that they discovered And then he like immediately regretted it. He's like, oh God, I'm gonna get in trouble. Like, so then he told me the whole story of like, you know, when the signal came in, what they thought about it. The whole process of the past few months at that point of you know, what it was like trying to figure out if the signal was real and doing the analysis. But even then, with only one version of the story, that wouldn't be enough. You have to have two people to be sure that you have, in journalism, to be sure that this is the truth, right? Two people. So, but at that point, I could email Kip and basically be like, well, Ray's already told me the whole story.
The master said that.
So he also agreed to talk, and he basically corroborated Ray's account and also, you know, gave me some new great details. So then I also talked to some people, some more modern people about just what it was like to build this experiment, just all the components to the experiment and how complicated it is. So we were able to write the whole story before the announcement and fact check it and copy edit and do everything, get all of our art together, so that when the announcement was made on February 11th, we could publish right then. And there were a lot of stories that day. There's kind of a glut. But I think what separated ours was just being able to tell it as, like, okay, here's what happened behind the scenes. Here's, here's the human side of this, right? So we start the article with the news and an overview of the implications about what we might learn about black hole populations, that kind of thing. But then the story really, really takes off with this line. Story of the first gravitational wave detection began on a Monday morning in September, and it started with a bang, a signal so loud and clear that Weiss thought, this is crap, it's got to be no good, right? So that they thought that the signal was possibly an injection of a false signal, or maybe even that the data had been hacked. So that was like how amazing this signal here was. So it was kind of hard for our story to break out over the masses, but just because when something gets covered so thoroughly, like even if we did do, you know, a good job, like our story did well for us, but it wasn't like the one that everybody was reading, you know. Even Fox News has a story, so. But what was really nice is that Ray wrote a few days later and said that our story was without doubt the very best of all the accounts of the experiment, the results, the human stories associated with the discovery. So that's really nice. I'll just remember that, you know, for forever. So we've continued to report on this this ongoing, really exciting story. And this one to the top left was a few days after the discovery story. And it was a Q&A with Daniel Kenefick, the author of that book, who's also a physicist, about the history going back to Einstein and kind of how Einstein's equations, you know, how you get from the equations and the prediction 100 years ago to actually knowing what the signal is going to look like and knowing how to find it. And that, you know, that was just such a long kind of rocky road. And then we've had, you know, a few others along the way. And then I hope to also find some new angles here in the next couple weeks. So that's that.
Questions?
So I'm curious, you mentioned fact checkers. So who does that?
So we have freelance fact checkers, a few of them. So it's whoever's available for a story. And they're usually Some of them are early career writers, because it's a really good way to learn the process of, you know, rigor and basically how to do it right if you're if you build that skill early. So that tends to be when you do it. Also, freelance writers will often fact check on the side as just an additional source of income. And then we have some fact checkers who are just lifetime fact checkers. Like, that's what their passion is. And yeah.
What's your relationship like with other science writers at places where the signal to noise is a lot worse?
Like, yeah.
How do you get on with them? How do you, you know?
Yeah.
What do they think of what you do?
Right. Well, I would say, like, the they like, I think everybody's happy to have more publications to either write for, or just people are in science writing are very mutually cheerleading. It's a nice community. So yeah, I think people really like Quanta, and also we do have a lot of freelancers, and a lot of my friends in science writing are a lot, you know, some of them do freelance for us. So trying to think of anything salacious, but
yeah,
not really.
I'm thinking of the Daily Mail or something like that, right?
Oh,
just like,
yeah. Well, I don't know what their deal is, but they, yeah, I think a lot of people are in a worse boat, mostly in terms of how quick their turnover is for stories. And I think, you know, I think people would probably see Quanta as this, like, great place that they would love to work. And not every, you know, there's, I got lucky. I got in on the ground floor with it. Yeah, there's still some other great places to work. Like, you know, I have a friend at Scientific American, and she's really happy. She loves it there. So, but then there's places like Life Science and Life's Little Mysteries and those, you know, that are great for, in some ways, you get great experience, but people tend to go and then, like, leave pretty quickly because it's so rough.
Yeah, I was curious, you mentioned the divide between female readership and male readership. Do you also have an idea of the age separation? In the era of Twitter, there's a generation that is used to just getting the short snippet and then moving on.
Yeah, I actually think our readers, we do have that information, but I don't quite remember what our, like, peak is, but I think it's maybe the 25 to 34 bracket. And there's nothing super surprising either way. It's like kind of an even spread. So we don't see any drop off with young readers, which is nice.
You mentioned the LIGO rumors, and so from within LIGO, they caused a lot of grief. But the counter argument has always been that it built public excitement and it helped the media get ready. And so I went, from your perspective, is it really great that there were rumors? And
yeah.
Is this an important part of getting science reporting?
Yeah, it is. It's really helpful that there's rumors. And in fact, that's happening right now because the LHC teams are presenting their big results in the next few days. And I'm, like, right now just desperately trying to get a sense of what will be presented. And rumors have helped a lot with that. So.
So you haven't had a personal conversation with any one of those, like with Grace, and then you know everything?
No. Yeah. They are tougher nuts to crack.
So in terms of communicating science in general, one of the things that we realized when the kind of wider LIGO scientific collaboration, there's a range of institutional sizes from big R1s universities to small universities, and not everybody has science writers on staff that can generate great stories, that have a science background and can write these great stories. Is contracting freelancers a good way to go for universities, maybe at the kind of small to mid-range schools, so they can make sure that the stuff gets communicated, particularly to local media markets effectively,
yeah,
rather than the big national announcements?
So there's kind of a separation a little bit between people who call themselves science writers and PR people. And so I think a lot of science writers would feel that they're crossing a line, like a dangerous line, by taking that kind of work. So there's that. But I think also because people are kind of desperate for work, there are people who would do it. And I think they, they're obviously, they're familiar with that process of translating research into good sentences. So that if you could find people like that, that would be a good way to go.
Great.
You mentioned Scientific American, so let me ask a question about that. I noticed that in the current incarnation, they avoid something like an XY graph almost in every article. That is, they seem to have a prejudice, like, we will not present this data in an XY plot. We'll use some other infographic or some, it looks like expensive generated graphics, but something as simple as a XY diagram, they'll never have it. Is that,
that
do you have a restriction on your own articles
sometimes have XY graphs,
But do you see this dumbing down? I mean, that's what I would call it.
You hear that about articles. Scientific American. I mean, I personally don't actually read it that much, so I don't have an opinion about that myself. But I think overall in the just ecosystem of science writing, I think there has been a big dumbing down over the past, couple of decades or decade. And I think also, sometimes an XY plot is not the way to go and there is something else, but we would never be like, oh, well, we can't do that on principle. Because sometimes it's just a lot easier.
Right.
Yeah. Gordy? Do you have a particular person or group in mind when you start to write an article?
So we are aiming our articles at the lay public. People who are interested in science, but, people who are interested in science, but they don't have to have any background knowledge. I think in practice, we tend to get pretty educated readers. It's the bulk of our readership. So either scientists or people with kind of technical jobs. And I think what we've learned from that is that, or something that I think is that people who are even like one field away or subfield away already need an article that's pretty much like a, without jargon and aimed at lay people. So really what we're seeing is just that the people who are interested in this kind of information tend to be, I think, educated, science savvy people, but we would love for everyone to read articles.
Would you like to hear from us, or would you contact us first?
I love when scientists email me and say, "Hey, this is a great paper. You guys should cover it." Or, obviously, like we're not always gonna decide to cover it, but that's fantastic. I mean, that's my ideal thing because. Then it just falls into my lap. I would say that, like, if anyone here, if you ever know of a story that you think Quanta should tell, then.
Yeah, I think that's an important reason we have the journalist residence here, both sides of her. She needs a rich Rolodex of people to call. When she gets somebody telling her it's a great paper, she needs to decide whether it's even true. And I think we're trying to break down those barriers that also people are comfortable.
What are the elements of a great science story for you?
I like if there's something really meaty that is complex enough that it really does take effort to try to distill it down and figure out how to explain the science in like a compelling way or a straightforward, easy to understand way. But that's because I think that's where we can, at Quanta, and I can play a special role is like we have more time to do that. And those are the kinds of developments that aren't being covered as much. But in terms of what makes a great story, I think it's always nice if you can trace it back to some black and white photo of some guy from the 19th century or something. if there's an arc, people have been asking a certain question for a really long time, and here we have a new development that relates to that question. And if people disagree, I think an important thing for any story, but including a science story, is having a tension. And you have to figure out what that tension is, but the beginning of the story basically has to present a tension, and then the end, by the end, you have to have resolved that in some way. It might not be we've completely solved that whole question, but it might be, the tension is some, minor subpoint that relates to some bigger question, and by the end, you have to have resolved that tension.
Do you have hard copies of this magazine?
There aren't actually hard copies, and I wish there was because I just like that. But and I think a lot of people really still want that, but we're just online only.
So, can I push a little bit about sort of the audiences for this writing? I mean, one could imagine sort of the average Fox News viewer versus somebody like me who can't understand the first sentence of any biology articles in Nature, but I'd like a version which I could appreciate, and they're sort of. There's a whole continuum, the excited high school student who wants to be a scientist or something. And do you see, I guess you're sort of aiming more at biology for astronomers or something rather than the Fox News viewer, but do you see an ecosystem there or the sort of important, there's a question of bringing science, more people into science, but maybe that's not this, but
yeah,
it's another avenue.
Yeah, I think that's a question we talk about, and that I think every science writer kind of grapples with is how do you get people who didn't know that they were interested in science to read a science article? Because I think what we're doing is providing great articles for people who, at whatever level of education or knowledge, are just interested in it. But it's getting to the people, and every once in a while you do, someone will give us feedback that's like, I didn't know that I was really interested in this stuff until I found Quanta or something. Or I'm sure there are some of those for every publication and stuff. But actually reaching those audiences is kind of a mystery. How do you do that?
So you mentioned the Bicep 2 fiasco. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could comment on, from the journalist perspective, did that change how you approach some of these large kind of scientific announcements, and more generally the perception of change in the community more broadly?
So I think there was a real change. And in fact, Ray Weiss talked about that a lot, that one reason they were really cautious about wanting to publish the paper, the same day that they did the announcement and not create this big media storm is because of Bicep 2. And I think it created more caution among scientists about not wanting things to be overhyped. And I think, in a way, there was maybe a bit too much blame put on the media because I think that the way Bicep 2 did it was, I think they should take most of the blame for that. But a lot of the coverage was also... a lot of the coverage was a little bit too just hook, line, and sinker, they found this and that's that. Our story was much more here's what their claim was, and if it's true, this is a huge deal. So I think we did it okay, but there was a lot of, error in the way all sides handled it. And I think it's been a big lesson for everyone, I think. So hopefully it's a good
So regarding the same thing, people do a story covering the discovery, but do they do a follow-up covering the this was nothing?
Yeah.
How was the case for Quanta?
So we actually did a couple of stories following up. That was like, I think, one way that we kind of, I was really proud of our coverage of that, because I think we were like, okay, well, we're not chasing traffic, so, and we don't, you know, we're not beholden to anyone for, like, how many people are actually going to read these stories, so we're just going to, like, do due diligence and say, like, okay, here's what happened, like, they didn't find anything, here's the details of, like, you know, why they got confused about dust, blah, blah, blah. So we did one story when, I think, when Planck came out with an analysis that showed that probably all of it was dust, and then another story when they actually, like, knew that it was dust for sure. And I think, yeah, that was good.
Andy? So you mentioned David Kaplan. I take it this is the Johns Hopkins particle physicist, David Kaplan. And
yeah.
What does he do for video?
Yeah, so the video series is kind of in flux a little bit because we're not sure how best like to use his skills and what our videos are trying to achieve. So we're kind of thinking about those things, but basically we have brainstorming sessions with him about like topics that we might, or actually beforehand, topics that we might want to cover in those videos, and then talk to him about it and like come up with them, and then he films them, like, kind of, he has this like improv or not extemporaneous style, and then we do afterwards motion graphics on top of it. So they're short videos, they're kind of like entry points. We're hoping that they'll reach viewers who are maybe, you know, some of those viewers who are less science savvy and are more just like clicking through video science videos out of, you know, curiosity, and then maybe from that they'll find the articles and some of the more like in-depth content that goes along with the articles.
Yeah. How common is it with the writers you work with or writers you know from other venues to be able to dive into the scientific paper itself that the story is based on and form an independent interpretation? Is that common or is that rare?
I don't think I would try to form my own interpretation of it, because that's just, I feel like that's a dangerous road to go down. But I definitely would read the papers, usually like not understanding them very well, but usually once I've done a few interviews for a story, maybe about some paper, then at that point I can read it and follow it. I wouldn't try to decide on my own what I think of it. I definitely can decide after speaking with a lot of people what, in fact, that's the point, that's what I should do, decide what kind of where to put the story in terms of the balance between different views and or just how to frame it based on like what people have said. And oftentimes that is a matter of, you know, of judgment.
Are your visitors, your readers, can you tell in which, are they biology, astronomy, quantum mechanics, what areas are more, attract most public attention?
So I think our most popular categories are math and physics, but I think that's because we're covering developments that other people aren't covering, so it's more like our brand and what we're known for. And the biology, we really ramped up biology coverage, and the biology stories are really good, but there's more competition there, I think. So in terms of who is reading, it's hard to, or I don't know if our survey like went that deep into like, if you are a scientist, what type of scientist are you? I don't think we asked that.
So. I have a follow-up question. How do you cover mathematics?
So we have this really fantastic math writer who's also a mathematician. Her name's Erica Klarich, she does most of our math coverage, and she's just brilliant. And I do some math coverage, and it's really Yeah, it's a lot harder for me. I like doing it because it's kind of like outside my comfort zone, but oftentimes I think in some ways it's actually, well, this is contradictory, but in some ways it's easier because I don't understand a lot about how math works, like how proofs work, you know. So sometimes I can just, I know where to draw the line, like, okay, well, I'm not going to get into that because it just, that doesn't make sense to me, or that's just too complex for me, so I'm not going to try to go there. So kind of the level that I'm reporting it at is kind of similar to the level that I'm going to be writing at, whereas in physics, sometimes I, like, just get too involved and, like, have to know everything about, like, how it works, and then, but I'm obviously going to have to, like, take a lot of steps back when I'm actually writing the.
Yes, I'm interested. I mean, after LIGO announcement, we found out that the public connects very emotionally to black holes and their emergence of gravitational waves. So yeah. I'm interested how does the public connect to mathematics?
Oh yeah, well, it's kind of amazing that people really want math coverage. Like people love math stories. I think even my friend at Scientific American was saying that they have fewer math stories than any other subjects, but math is like, every story they have is just like the
puzzles.
Traffic is huge on it. Yeah, like people just love them. And I think it's because when you're trying to escape from your regular life, like in, you know, the beauty of like how science works and it's so rational, I think math is the ultimate of that. It's like, they proved this real thing that you're definitely sure is like absolutely true. No way. No, I think people really like that.
On that note, it's like